Hello and welcome to the Transmedia Podcast. This is me, Robert Pratton, and you can find me online on Twitter as Rob Pratton. And we've been away for a little while, but now we're back. And we've actually got a two-parter. We're kicking off, let's say, the new season of podcasts with Leonie Reynolds. She's a transmedia storyteller and a pervasive game designer from New Zealand. And I'd met Leonie at WeirdCon, trying to think when that was, well, many months before we met up again at ArgFest in Portland. And we just talked for quite some time, and I didn't want to wrap it up prematurely, so I've broken the interview into two parts, and they're both really worth listening to. So I'll shut up now, and here I am kicking off with Leonie in part one.
Well, I have a filmmaking background, and I just recently discovered interactivity and interactive games and alternate reality games, and I've gotten really excited about that, and I wanted to... Frequency was kind of like a proof of concept for me. I wanted to try out some ideas that I'd had in terms of interactive storytelling. And so what I wanted to do was actually lay a story trail through the streets of Wellington, my hometown, and see if I could actually... challenge an audience to be as interactive as possible and go on basically a two-hour adventure through the streets and interacting with actors, getting texts, solving puzzles, and being... It was kind of an experiment to see if audiences would be as bold as I thought they could be. And I'm happy to say that it worked really well, and they were really bold. I mean, one of the things that happened at the end of the script was that the audience, there was a truck which was a secret agent base of a secret agent from an alternate universe, and at that point in the script I wrote, then the audience ties up the secret agent, and I had everyone who looked at my script looking at me skeptically and going, do you really think the audience is going to tie up a secret agent, and how are they going to know that they need to tie up a secret agent? Well, I'm happy to report back that they did tie up the secret agent. And I was actually sitting in the front of the truck while this was going on with a baby monitor listening to what was going on in the back. And it was actually hilarious. I used to have to stifle my laughter because, you know, you'd hear the audience would arrive at the secret agent base when the guy wasn't there. They'd explore the base, then he'd show up unexpectedly, and there would be shrieks, and the truck would start rocking. I don't even know half of the stuff they did to the poor guy. But he would always be, he would be grabbed, he would be tied up, he would be interrogated. Sometimes he would be interrogated nicely, sometimes he would be interrogated aggressively.
They didn't waterboard him, did they?
Some of them, well, we did actually leave a ray gun in the back of the truck for the audience, and sometimes he would be shot. One time he was shot repeatedly and he ended up screaming, what did he say? Yes, stop that now, you sadistic bitch. I hope I can say that in your podcast.
You say whatever you want in your podcast.
And I mean, it was hilarious. And I mean, obviously, you know, that wasn't in an aggressive way. It was everyone was having fun. So, yeah. And so I kind of designed the experience to try and get the audience to be as bold as they possibly could right from the beginning, because, you know, that was kind of the end goal, was to have an audience who would tie up an actor and, you know, to kind of give them the subtle clues that yes, you can do this, this is okay. And what I did on the actual location to make that possible was I had a coil of rope lying invitingly next to the chair.
You send them all the cues.
Yeah, but of course that's not enough if the audience aren't feeling bold enough to take it on. And so it was kind of like my personal challenge to send that message every opportunity that I could right from the advertising. And so the tagline was, are you bold enough, in the advertising and the posters and flyers for the show. And again, I had some people saying, ooh, are you sure you should ask the people that? You know, are you sure that won't put people off? And my response to that was, that will only put off the people who I want to put off.
Yeah.
Because I was already trying to select, get the audience to self-select to the kind of people who would enjoy this experience. Because Frequency was part of the New Zealand International Fringe Festival, which is officially a theatre festival. And so I really didn't want people accidentally going to my show who thought they were going to be able to sit in a theatre and watch a show.
Right.
Yeah. Or even who thought they'd be walking through the streets, but they'd just be watching scenes play out, you know, and get to stand back. Because, you know, there's only a certain kind of person who is actually going to enjoy the kind of experience that I wanted to create and who is going to be willing to participate in the kind of experience that I wanted to create. And, yeah, so I started with the Are You Bold Enough tag. Then when people actually, and I made it clear that people would be walking through the streets of Wellington and solving puzzles and interacting, so I made it as clear as I possibly could in the advertising. And then on the morning of the actual show, I was texting audience members individually, and I should say that this was achievable because we only had 8 audience members per show. And there's no way that this experience would have been possible, I think, with more people. And so that was a conscious decision to try and create the perfect experience, basically. And I kind of threw everything at it that I could. And so the morning of the show, everyone got a text. So it would be, good morning, Susan, welcome to Frequency. And gosh, I can't remember the exact wording, but they were asked to respond with copy that, so that was the first invitation to it that they actually had to interact.
They had to confirm.
Yeah, yeah. And so they all sent copy that, which was great. And then they were asked that they had to assess themselves on three levels. Leadership, initiative, and some third one, I can't remember. And they had to assess themselves out of 10, send me back the results. They sent me back the results. They were then sent, congratulations, you and one other audience member have been chosen to be evaluated to be one of our secret agents. And everyone got that text. But the effect of that text was everyone felt special. They were all given a code name at that point as well. They were given a code phrase and response, and they were told that they would need to use that at some point during the show, and they needed to be ready. So this was all designed to get people to work on people's subconscious throughout the day. So these texts all went out between 8 and 9 in the morning, and then there was nothing else for the rest of the day before the show. So the idea was...
And the show started at like 7 or 8?
8 o'clock,
yeah, 8
p.m.
o'clock at night, yeah.
Yeah, and I did have a number of people say to me that they'd been excited all day about going to the show, which was what I wanted. And yeah, so they evaluated themselves, they felt challenged, they felt that they'd been chosen, and they were given a secret that they held all day. They also weren't sure when they were going to use it, so there's a slight element of nervousness in there, which all kind of feeds into basically excitement and sort of feeling ready to go on an adventure. And I'm pretty sure that, I mean, people really loved the show, and I'm sure that part of that was the fact that they were contacted so early in the day.
Yeah.
And so they had all day, this was sitting in their subconscious working on them, so they came absolutely primed for the experience. You know, expecting the kind of experience that they were going to get and wanting that kind of experience and feeling like they'd been validated.
Be something special. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so people had bought tickets for this as well, hadn't they?
Yes.
So on the flyer, you know, the taglines be "Are you bold enough?" But what was the kind of were they told they were going to be select a secret service type mission or?
They were told. Oh, gee, I don't. Let me try and remember. They were told. I think they were told they would receive secret tech from a shadowy organisation, but they weren't told that they would be assessed for anything. So
right.
This was a surprise. They were told that someone had gone missing. And can you help find her? So
right,
they were
okay,
told
right.
that there was going to be... They knew that there was going to be a quest, basically. But they...
On the streets of Wellington.
Yes, on the streets of Wellington was, you know, very clear...
So they knew that could be active.
Yes.
And,
yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I also had no door sales because, we ended up selling out, which, you know, which was great. But, yeah, I wanted it to be only the people who were fully primed for the show.
Right,
you know, and I didn't
right,
want
right.
any...
So by
random,
doors, you mean
yeah.
like people who bought tickets in advance?
People who just walk in and go,
yeah,
can
okay,
I have a
yeah.
ticket now? And actually I heard that it was kind of sad because word of mouth spread really fast for the show and people were turning up asking for tickets, which was kind of heartbreaking but also kind of cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Now what? So, was this the first sort of theatre, like immersive theatre type thing that you'd done, basically?
Yeah.
And so, what made you want to do something interactive, having come from film and TV?
Well, I was at WeirdCon the previous year, and well, the reason I was at WeirdCon was that I had become interested in this kind of thing. And to be honest, I can't remember the actual trigger that sort of first drew me into this, but as soon as I started discovering alternate reality games, that really resonated with me. And I think, because in my background in film, my focus has always been the audience experience.
Right.
And so when I'm writing a screenplay, I'm always thinking, what will they feel at this point? What do I want them to feel here? How can I scare them here? How can I make them feel this or that? And I'm always referring back to their experience. And so this kind of interactive thing is even more all about audience experience. And I think that's what draws me to it, because I think what really drives me is giving people amazing experiences.
Right.
And it doesn't, the medium is almost irrelevant. It's more like, how can I give people the most intense experience possible? And I realized that as an audience member, I would far rather be in a movie than watch one. And so I wanted to give people the experience of being in a movie. And actually, someone, after the first night, someone actually texted a really lovely text that said that part of it was, frequency makes you feel like you've been dropped into a movie. And I was like, yes!
Brilliant.
Yes, yeah. This is what I wanted people to feel. So, yeah. Yeah,
that's
wanted that kind of magical sense of possibility, you know, that anything can happen and anything around you could be part of the experience. So, yeah.
And so, how did you sort of go about designing this? Like, what were the parameters you set yourself?
Okay, well, yeah, it was a real challenge because I was kind of inventing the wheel, really. And I had a co-writer on board for some of the time, which was really good because, it's great to bounce ideas off someone. And, it was okay, let's see. Part of it, I didn't entirely know how I was going to create it because I'd never done anything like this before. The first thing I did was decide where it was going to happen physically. And so I thought, okay, what is the nicest part of Wellington to walk through? You know, because I'll start with people walking through, you know, start with that being a pleasant experience, then time it, kind of figure out roughly how far do I think people can walk, you know, in what I thought was going to be 90 minutes to 2 hour show.
Right.
It turned out being 2 hours, a little bit longer than I would have liked, but really I had no idea how long it was going to take, because the path that we chose for people to walk through takes 20 minutes if you're just walking from point A to point B.
Right.
Now, people were stopping and going on treasure hunts during that time, interacting with actors, getting texts. And then you factor in with that as well, it's a random group of people and you don't know how fast they're going to walk, whether they're going to stop and dilly-dally, or, you know, so
yeah.
There was a massive amount of unknowns, and my major fear was that the show was going to be too short and people were going to do it in 45 minutes or something, and it wasn't really going to feel like a proper show. So I was quite relieved in a way that it took 2 hours, but again, I would have really liked to shave a bit of time off that, because I think 90 minutes is probably
about
perfect.
Right.
So anyway, so what I did was I found the route that I wanted them to take, which was from a theatre in Wellington. It started in the bar of Bat Theatre in Wellington, and it ended up on the waterfront, which is a very picturesque walk. They walk past a lagoon, they walk past some statues, they walk over a pretty picturesque bridge. There's a lot of art. And then during the walk, I kind of walked around. I went, okay, where is a good place to hide something? And what could these objects be? So I did this before I even had a story.
Right, so you're thinking about the user experience, the audience experience.
Yeah,
right.
So it was like, it was going to be built around the location. So one of the, like what I think feel like is the iconic image from the show is a bunch of people standing under a suspended silver ball in the middle of Civic Square, which is a sculpture all holding their cell phones up to the ball. And so, like, I, you know, this ball, it was obviously going to have to be a transmission device. You know, people were obviously going to have to stand underneath it. And then there was the lagoon. It was like, okay, how am I going to use this? It's a small lagoon. So obviously, you know, this is how my mind was working. People are going to need to break into two groups and go, I just remembered that was kind of stage two. Stage one, the first version of the how to use the lagoon idea was it was going to be a radio-controlled boat that was going to deliver a message from the other world.
Oh, wow.
And it was going to arrive, and there was going to be an augmented reality app that people were going to have on. People were going to have been given a phone with an app on it. They were going to scan a message on the boat. That ended up being really seriously in the too hard basket. So I ended up breaking them into two groups, putting them on either side of the lagoon, and they semaphored a message to each other. So each of them had half of the code, and they had to send it to the other half. And that actually ended up working really well. So it was one of those cases of, you know, necessity actually creating a better idea.
Yeah. And did you know how many people were going to be in each sort of batch, in each show?
Well, I decided 8.
Right.
Was
just kind of arbitrarily. Yeah.
Arbitrarily, I just kind of thought this seems like a good number. I don't want it to grow so big that it will fragment into two groups, and it felt like 8 was the largest size that you could get before that would start to happen. Plus, I also had a mole in the group, so there were actually 9 audience members in total.
So you walk around and you're looking at the space and you're looking at opportunities to sort of leave clues or hide stuff.
Yeah.
And then what would you do then? Would you try to write on the spot while you're looking at it, or would you then go back to like a garret somewhere?
Yeah, I went back to my garret. So I took photos of all the locations so that I could, you know, look at them and think about them. And then I kind of had a list of maybe it was a dozen locations.
Did you have them like storyboarded out or something?
No, not visually. So I basically had a list, and I thought, you know, okay, if they spend 5 minutes at each location and it takes this many minutes to walk, then how many locations do I need to have?
Right, right.
And the final location that ended up being in a truck, that was a real challenge because I was actually trying to find a room. I wanted it to happen in a room. And I tried to get it to happen in a bar, and I was going to have, at that point in the show, which was basically the final location of the show, I was going to have an actor come into the bar with a suitcase, and inside the suitcase was going to be a whole bunch of props that essentially explained anything that you didn't already know or didn't already understand.
Right.
And I was going to leave the audience with the case and with maybe a physical puzzle or two to solve. And I ended up not doing that because I found a bar. They were very happy to have the show there. Then they mentioned that February was their busiest month.
Yes.
And I thought, do these guys know what they've agreed to? They've basically agreed to saving a table for 8 people who will show up 3 nights a week for 3 weeks. Probably not drink or eat anything, you know, stay there for like an hour or I don't even know how long, and then disappear. And I thought, it's only a matter of time before I get the phone call, like, you know, really sorry, but you can't keep taking up our table space.
Yeah.
So I pulled the plug on that venue, and again, it was one of those ideas that ends up better because you've found a difficulty and you've had to be a little bit more ingenious.
Yeah, because the band idea sounds
fantastic. Yeah.
I mean, like that, and it really feels like what you would do as a spy, trying to sell out in the back of a van.
Yeah. And that was really, and you know, because I finally realised that it was actually a lot more fun to be, you know, where would you rather be? Would you rather be in a bar, or would you rather be in the back of a secret agent's van?
I guess it depends on the circumstances.
Yeah.
So, How did you... there's a big crowd that's now started gathering around us, but we'll continue. So how did you start to pull this all together as you were writing the story?
Well, I started out with the just deciding fairly arbitrarily to do a parallel universe story. You know, it's one of the more used tropes of this kind of thing, but it's a used trope for a reason. You know, it's really functional. And I decided to do a missing agent because, again, you know, that gives you a quest. And so started out with really, really broad strokes and then just kind of just worked from there. And then we decided to have that a lot of what people discovered was going to be notes from the missing agent. And we realized that we could actually create flashbacks by finding notes that were written later, finding them earlier, so you can kind of play with time.
Okay.
So on this journey, yes,
the notes weren't necessarily...
They weren't in order,
right,
no.
Right.
So she announces that she's found something and then she's going to investigate it. And and then the order is jumbled. Like, you know, she's going to follow someone, and you know that's found quite late, and you think, oh my goodness, that's what happened to her in the end.
So that's kind of like, I mean, that story order. Were you thinking at that time, like drawing on your experience from the film and the TV, like thinking, well, this is going to work? Because it wasn't like an open world story in that people were just let loose and they could go to any location at any time. There was like a sequence, wasn't it? Is that correct? There was a sequence of...
There was a very definite sequence. So, and I was actually thinking three-act structure as well.
Right.
I was thinking what location is going to be the midpoint, what location is going to be the third act.
Right.
So I was definitely... And I kind of bounced in and out of thinking of it in three-act structure order because I didn't want to... Yeah, because sometimes you just kind of need to go be a bit intuitive about it and just think about the experience. Another thing that I realised in writing this kind of thing is that the structure isn't as vital as it is in film, because people already have a higher level of engagement because they're physically in the space, they're physically...
They're doing stuff,
they're also talking to each other. I also tried to allow small gaps in there so that... for them to talk to each other, because I didn't want to just pepper them with story points the way you do in a movie when they literally have nothing else to do except watch your movie.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, you don't want to have any lag time at all. But in this show, I felt that part of the experience was them bonding as a group.
Right.
And so part of the show was they... were being given little exercises in which they had to exchange code words with each other without the rest of the group knowing. And so that was kind of tricky because, I really just had to guess, you know, am I giving enough time for this? But, I was plotting out gaps in the show, like, okay, they've just met... there was an agent in a van that they met early in the experience, and so it's like, okay, they've just met this guy, they're going to have a lot to talk about. So for the next... I'm going to give them nothing else to do for the 2-minute walk to the phone box because they're going to be talking about the actor.
Right.
And so, you know, I want to give them some time to do that.
To be plotting and wondering.
Yeah.
And the intergroup activities, how did that mesh with the story that you had?
That was a little bit separate to the story. And that was actually a late addition to the show, the intergroup activities. And again, it was one of those things of a problem making the show stronger. Because initially, the show that I had planned was a lot more... The audience was going to be a lot more passive, and they were going to be receiving a lot of texts that were conversations between the characters, and they were going to essentially be passively following this experience along. Then I discovered that texts weren't always arriving.
Oh.
And and at the time I blamed Mighty Text, which I was using, but I've since discovered that it wasn't Mighty Text's fault, that there was actually a cell phone black hole
in the midst of my route.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Which is not something, you know, again, you know, beginner's mistake, you know, to not actually check whether the cell phone coverage was constant for my cell phone dependent
show.
Well,
it is 2014. You would expect in 2014 you can get a text message from someone in the center.
Yeah. Actually, you know, this is another thing that was highly risky in terms of the show, because the text had to arrive virtually instantaneously, or I would have had no show, because I was sending conversations, overheard conversations to the audience. I was texting back and forth to the audience, and if there'd been a time lag, there would have been a real problem.
Right.
In actual fact, I heard that on some nights there was a time lag on some people's phones.
Yeah.
And this was fortunately, you know, it's like fortunately it was a group experience, and so the people whose texts didn't arrive were able to catch up based on the people whose texts did arrive.
So they all got the same text? Because you were sending these texts from the front of the van, weren't you? You were sat in the van.
I was sitting in the front of the. I was sitting in the front of the truck in the final location.
Yeah.
Yeah, sending. And what I actually did was I sent the entire show, because I have an iPhone, so I couldn't actually write draft messages, and it was like, how on earth am I going to do this? So I sent the entire show to another phone, so that I had them all sitting in my sent message folder. And then I was sending sent messages to the group.
Forwarding
sent messages. So some of the messages were manually written, but most of them were already written, and so I was just hitting forward, 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 forward.
Okay.
So originally it was going to be much more text-heavy, and I look back and I think, well, thank goodness it actually didn't work. So what I ended up doing was I stripped out a whole lot of the text, and that was when I created the notes that people were finding. So they ended up finding a whole lot more stuff. They especially found stuff in the cell phone dead spots where no cell phone messages could get through. So it was like, okay, from the beginning of the bridge to the middle of the bridge, which is quite a long distance, there can't be any text. So everything has to be driven by physical objects, you know, in this space. And I did that, and then it was like, okay, I now have holes in my story. I don't think I have enough content because all these texts have been stripped out. How am I going to occupy the audience? And I'd had this kind of vague idea for getting people to swap code words, and it was like, great, I'll do that. And so I basically grabbed at the code phrases had nothing to do with the actual story of the show. So you could have actually completely lifted that out, and the show would have still worked. So it was essentially just busy work for the audience to do. So, and let's see, I had them, again, I
can't... Because they wouldn't have known if it was part of the recruitment exercise anyway, because
no,
they've been told
yeah,
to go off
yeah,
and...
Yeah, so they were essentially told it was part of the recruitment exercise, and they were told things like, I pulled some questions from personality tests off the internet, and it was things like, I prefer to plan things rather than be impulsive. If this is true, include the word blue in your conversation with your partner. If this is false, include the word red with your conversation with your partner. And what the partner would only be told, your partner is going to use the word blue or the word red. You know, text this word through when you've received it.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah. So there was mystery there, and it felt like their partner was engaged in something really secret and devious, and you know, they didn't know what it was. And then again, the person who was sending the message felt that they were being paid personal attention to, you know, and that who they were was important to the
That's
show.
That's really good. And that, so how did you know who were partnered up with each other to send them?
Well, that was something that I kind of slightly learnt the hard way, in that initially I paired people up with people that they hadn't come with, because I thought they hadn't come with. And then I discovered that there were things like people who were late or people who didn't come to the show, and then suddenly you've got a problem. And fortunately I had actually, I had physical envelopes at the beginning location that I'd actually created if for some reason someone didn't get the text. So there was a message from Resistor Command that happened to include all of the information that they would have needed, that they would have received, and that included their code name, their code phrase, everything that they needed. So the shows where this happened, the show could still go on, but I realised that it was that I basically had to pair people up with the people they came with, so that if two people don't show up, it's not a problem. You know, we don't have to do
it's
any...
It's a self-contained unit,
And also, if, you know, someone is late, then only their friend suffers. some other random person that I unfortunately paired them with doesn't suffer. So, oh, and they were also told when they were given their code name and their code phrase, they were told, you know, do not share this with other audience members. Part of the evaluation is about your discretion.
Brilliant.
So,
yeah.
You know, so some people, I don't know who shared it with their friends and who didn't. But yeah, that was up to them, and I gave them a motivation to not share. So
that's really cool. So tell us, you know, how the game would evolve when people first turned up. What happened? So they'd get the text in the morning. They're excited all day.
Yes. Okay. So what happens is they sit down at a table. There is an envelope for each person on the table with their code name on it. And the code names
And how did they know to go to that specific location? Where did they get
that information? They were told that it would begin at Understudy Bar at Bat Theatre. So turn up at this time, don't be late.
And was that on the original ticket when they bought it, or was that on the ticket?
Yeah, it was on the ticket, yeah.
Yeah, okay,
so there was no mystery as to where it started. So they turned up. There was a front of house person who would, you know, welcome them, sort of point them to the direction of the table. I was never physically there, so I'm relying on, you know, what I know was planned to happen and what other people told me happened. So the front of house person would welcome them. There was a table with all the envelopes on it with all the code names, and the code names were all of quantum physicists that I'd pulled off the internet. So there was Dirac, Dyson, of course Schrodinger, and so on. They would be waiting for the show to start when someone would come into the bar and come up to them and say he was looking for his girlfriend who'd gone missing and show her photo. And they would generally, I think, work out fairly quickly that this was part of the show.
And this was an actor
was an actor, yeah. So, and he would show her picture, talk about... And he kind of set the scene for the world, because in this world, basically the backstory is people from an alternate universe have been pulling radio energy out of our universe to power their universe, and we're about to suffer frequency collapse.
Right.
So emails are going astray, texts are going astray. This is part of the justification for why they get other characters' texts onto why the audience gets other characters' texts onto their phone, and pieces of emails and that sort of thing. So the actor was a LARPer, so he was very experienced at improvising, and he would just talk about some of the weird things that had happened happening in the world. Emails aren't going through, microwaves have started playing music, you know, this morning at 3 o'clock all the birds chirp for a minute and then they just stop dead, you know. Just kind of creating an uncanny atmosphere, basically telling you this is...
And this was scripted, so you'd written this for him?
I had only just given him basic guidelines and then said go for it. So I basically told him the goals of the scene.
Right.
And that was it. And then I relied on his LARPing skills, basically.
Because this was part of the recruitment for the actors in the piece, wasn't it? That they had LARPing skills.
Yeah,
it wasn't a random thing.
No. I actually sought out actors with LARPing experience because... I felt that people with LARPing experience, they're used to improvising, but they're used to improvising in a very relaxed, natural way. And I felt that I was a lot safer with people with that kind of experience than with regular actors who may seem like they're great performers, who may be great performers, but they're not used to riffing in a believable way.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're used to performing other people's words. Whereas LARPers have massive experience at making up their own stuff in their own imaginary
and
world.
And their own characters.
Yeah.
How much did the actors sort of bring stuff to the character?
Well, I had... there was a really great plot point that was introduced by one of the actors. To just quickly summarise the story, this guy's looking for his girlfriend, she's gone missing, she's maybe been involved in the shadowy organisation. He shows the logo of the shadowy organisation, he then disappears. The audience then has some written tests that they need to do. they then leave. They then... A phone rings, it's hidden under the table. when they discover the phone, texts start coming through the phone, and it's a conversation between Resistor Command and Agent 5 that seems to be happening in real time. Then Agent 5 is attacked, calls for help, sends through an image of a blood-stained map, which is... that's when the audience, that's their cue to leave.
Right.
And they then go and find the van, which is around a couple of blocks away from the theatre. There's an injured actor in the van.
This is the first van, isn't it?
Like, this is the first... Well, there's the truck, which is the final experience, which is the big, bad, evil guys. And then there's the small van, which is our underdog resistance movement, which is kind of hippified, and it's got, sort of smells of incense and a hippie throw and some wanted posters. And one of the wanted posters is of the missing girlfriend. So at this point, we realise that she is actually a secret agent. And the audience has to... the actor has bandages. The audience needs to heal him, give him some water, give him an anti-ray gun pill, and they have
brilliant,
like
yeah.
a 10-minute scene with him in the van, and he introduced a plot point that I wish I'd thought of actually, one night he said quite early in the season he was talking about Sylvia, the missing woman. And because they were secret agents together, and he said, she's my partner, and everyone gasped because they thought he meant, she's my girlfriend. And so he just ran with this for the rest of the season. What do you mean? What do you mean? She's not this guy's girlfriend. She's my girlfriend. And that obviously always went down brilliantly because the laugh from the first scene was he can be very persuasive, and so he can come across as a very moving, earnest guy. Everyone's heart had gone out to this poor guy who was looking for his girlfriend. So it was a really wonderful plot reversal to find out that this guy's been lying, or at least they think he's been lying. Who's really telling the truth? Whose girlfriend is she really? So, yeah, so that was something that an actor's creativity brought to the show.
That's really cool. And so what's interesting about the van as well, that's another space that you can control.
Yes. And again, the van is also a space that was that wasn't my first choice, because originally I wanted to do a show. I wanted to do that scene in another bar that was just around the corner, and the people at that bar, they were lovely, but they would just never call me back. And when I'd talked to them five times, and I'd never got a call back, and it was all, that sounds great,
we'll
call you.
Your alarm bells are going off, this play out.
I kind of went, I have to move on from this. And so I ended up, using a van behind that building. And that was an example of one of the things that you think should be easy, but is incredibly not easy, because it took me at least 3 weeks of multiple emails and phone calls to get permission to park in this space. It was a little council-owned car park behind the Opera House that basically no one parks in at night, and yet it was this thing of, no, we lease all those spaces. No, you can't lease one of them. No, we won't tell you who leases them. So, and I would have had to rewrite the whole show, because physically, it was really key that they go through there, because there was a phone box that was going to ring at the end of the alley that they had, they had to go through this way. It's actually a really nice visual alley with lots of very attractive graffiti, and it was really key to the show. But, I did end up thinking, at what point do I just have to rewrite? But eventually I did what I should have done at the beginning, which was actually walk around all the businesses and say in the area and say, do you have a car park behind the Opera House? Can I please borrow it? And it was about the third shop I went into. Well, yes and yes.
Oh,
it was like, my goodness, I can't believe I spent 3 weeks sending emails.
To the council.
Yeah.
Carolina.
Yeah.
So what's interesting there is that's basically a producer's job. Normally, like, the writer goes, oh, you sound going, so I need a massive big crane shot that's going to come out and like, then get lumbered with a problem.
But, yeah, so well, I was writer, director, producer. And, you know, I would have loved to have a producer to do this for me. Believe me.
But the thing is, what I think is good about it is that you're creative problem solving all the time.
Yes.
So it's not like you're sort of, not that you would throw attention, but it's not like, well, I absolutely need it. And someone else has to do it.
Yeah.
You're saying, okay, right, so that's not going to go right. What can I
yeah.
do?
Yeah, yeah.
So that's quite interesting, I think. You know, to be, you know, like to be having to deal with a problem creates a better result in the end. I think that's quite interesting, which might not have materialised had someone else been doing it, because they wouldn't have known necessarily what the creative solution was.
Yeah, that's probably true. And also I think when it's your creative project, you can be a lot more persuasive. You know, you can walk in
with the shopkeeper,
and
the
you can stare them pleadingly in the eyes, and you can pitch your entire show to them. Whereas someone who was a producer, I mean, ideally your producer is absolutely on the same page with you, but you know, that's another ask. You know, it's a big ask for your producer to be able to come in the same way and to be able to kind of riff on the spot about the show and why it's going to be so great and why they so desperately need your parking space, sort of thing. So, yeah.
Really good. And so you did the thing with the phone ringing at the end of the...
Yeah. So I had... when people walked down this quite cool alley, found... then they looked around the corner and they saw a van with the logo on it of the secret organisation that they'd seen the guy with the missing girlfriend show. So that was their signal that, you know, you need to go up to this van and this is...
So the guy, like, when they went to the chap that they had to sort of apply the medical bandages to, did he tell them you need to sort of head in that direction or something?
He did in the end, yeah. So they had about a 10-minute scene with him in which he explained more of the backstory. And then he said he had a message that they had a written puzzle that my mole, who I had in the show, was also a puzzle designer, so he designed some puzzles. There was a puzzle that they needed to solve to get a dead drop number that this agent was supposed to deliver, and of course he couldn't deliver it because he'd just been shot with a ray gun. And so he then had to ask them if they could fulfill his mission and deliver this crucial message.
Got it.
And they were then told, they weren't told that they needed to go to the phone box, they were just told that they needed to go to the end of the alley. And it was set up so that they would be expecting another actor to show up. Because in New Zealand, phone boxes don't ring. They're all set up, you know, so that it's, incoming calls are blocked.
Right.
And so when we actually got a phone box to ring, people really, they just did their nut. They were so excited. One girl jumped up and down, I heard.
How did you manage to do that then? If they
well,
were blocked?
This was kind of the reverse of the getting a car park behind the Opera House thing. This was something that you would think would be really difficult. It was actually really easy.
Just phone so, up the phone companies.
Well, yeah, basically the hard part about that was just figuring out who ran the phone boxes up for telecom. And, you know, I had to make about 5 different phone calls to find that out, because nobody rings up to find out who runs the phone boxes. So, and then once I found the guy, he was a very charming Frenchman, Didier Ravel, thank you very much. So it was, yes, of course, you know, sure, that sounds like fun. Yes, we can do that for you.
So, there you go, that's
yeah,
really good.
Yeah. And so, and then that was me again. I was the voice on the other end of the phone. And so I had a, as part of our crew, we had an invisible witness whose job it was to tag along behind the audience and watch everything they were doing and to report back to me so that I could in real time text the audience as resistor command, and if someone was lagging behind I could tell them to catch up or whatever, and it would be a little bit freaky because, you know, how do you know?
Yeah. So this is quite interesting, I think. So there's 2 additional people that are on the crew. One is a mole inside the group.
Yes.
And they don't know that he's not another guest.
That's right.
And then you've got the invisible witness, someone else who's, like, hiding in the corners,
yes,
just watching, observing, and
yes,
reporting back to you.
Yes. And so the mole was there in case people didn't find a package or, well, you know, just...
Why don't we look over there? Like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So to, and you know, I cast someone who I had LARPed with and who I knew was not going to have any ego problems with stepping back, because, you know, if you cast the wrong person in that role, it would be a disaster.
You know, solving all the problems for
exactly, everyone. Exactly. You know, someone. You know, there are plenty of people who would just take that as an opportunity to show off. You know, but this guy, he's a LARP designer himself, so he fully understands, you know, supporting the audience experience.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, he was absolutely able to take a back seat and, you know, not be able to solve things and, you know.
And so, what made you think then that if you've got a mole in the group already, why would you need the silent witness?
Okay, I needed the witness because I needed real time information, because the mole couldn't be texting me going, oh, so and so. In fact, he said, like, he did text me occasionally, but he said it was quite difficult because people were watching each other.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Especially when
yeah, and also because I needed real time, like the invisible witness, one role that they fortunately weren't called on for was problem solving in case there was some massive problem. Like, let's say council workers erected a giant barrier across the alley that we weren't expecting, or there was a car accident, or there was, you know, drunk people, you know, harassing the audience or something, so they could actually basically step out of character. Well, they weren't in, you know, they didn't officially have a character. So they could go and solve a problem, or they could go and entice the drunk people away, or, you know.
Got it. Yeah, really.
And I also had a stage manager who I gave $20 to, for like, if you need to bribe someone to, like, just get off the hell off that bench that they're on,
or
whatever.
Or if they're on the phone or something,
yeah,
please, will you put that phone down right now, because I need it.
Yeah. Exactly, Yeah, so they were there for, you know, for unforeseen issues, because you just, you know, you're out there in the wilds of a real city, and you know, you can plan all you like, but that doesn't mean that nothing's going to go wrong. But yeah, fortunately we didn't actually have any of that scale of problem go wrong.
So that's the end of part one, and sorry to cut it off there. You can find Leone online as mysterious-stranger.co.nz, or for the American listeners, mysterious-stranger.co.nz. We will be back with part two next week.